today on Family Talk.
You know what Mark Twain said about adolescence? He said, when a child turns 13 years of age, you should put him in a barrel, nail a lid down on the barrel, and feed him through a knot hole. And when he turns 16, you should seal up the knot hole.
Oh, my goodness. You know, sometimes I felt like my dad wanted to stuff me into a barrel until I grew out of my teenage years, but I think now he's glad he refrained. Hi, everyone. Ryan Dobson here for Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk, and I am so excited that in 2 days, the 1st through the 5th, you can screen the very first film for free. No charge. All you have to do is sign up at buildingafamilylegacy.com. You can screen it in your church, your small group, your home, anywhere with an internet connection, as long as you sign up at buildingafamilylegacy.com. But for now, in celebration of the release of Building a Family Legacy, we're going to wind back the clock and enjoy the audio portion of my dad's presentation on preparing for adolescence from that original film series. So here now is my dad, Dr. James Dobson, all the way back in 1978, talking about adolescence and puberty on today's edition of Family Talk.
First, let me begin for those who still have the younger children and you're able to influence the development between there and adolescence, early adolescence. May I suggest that you postpone adolescence till your kids get there? See, there is an entire movement that would come. Thank you. There is an entire movement now that would bring the teenage ethic and all that it means, all of that heterosexual competitiveness and the beauty and all of that down and sell it to your preschool kids and especially your preschool girls. And at the forefront of this movement is the Barbie doll movement. Folks, I hate Barbie dolls. Thank you. I've got a crusade going against Barbie dolls, probably because I have a house full of them, and a little late to be trying to get rid of them, and now they're kind of cast aside. But I didn't really realize the impact of those dolls until it was too late. But if I had it to do over again, I don't think I would allow them to come in the door if I had a choice, primarily because Barbie sets up an image that will be impossible for any child to meet later on. See, you take a little 3-year-old girl who ought to be playing with teddy bears and Walt Disney kinds of things and the traditional memorabilia of childhood. And instead, here is Barbie, this perfect creature who does not have flaws. Barbie does not have acne on her face. Barbie does not have fat anywhere on her body. Her legs are long and thin. Her skin is airbrushed. Barbie's hair has body, whatever in the world that is. Barbie is busty. It's a phenomenon for a 13-year-old girl. Folks, there is not a flaw anywhere on Barbie's pink body except for a little statement on her bottom that says she's made in Hong Kong. And you see, when you give those dolls to a little girl who's 3 or 4 or 5 and she plays with them for 6 or 7 years, it sets up an image of what she'd better have when she's 13. And when she gets to be 13, she looks in the mirror, and no doubt about it, Barbie she ain't. And the gap between life as it is and life as it ought to be is dramatized by the perfection of that doll and all of those that she symbolizes. And even the creator of Barbie recognizes the impact and the negative aspects of it. But it's not just the beauty of Barbie that bothers me. It's the adolescent games that she inspires. You see, Barbie gets little girls into teenage things, into dating kinds of games, and getting married and having babies and taking camping trips, and hopefully in that order. But it gets them to think about all the adolescent stuff. And, you know, Barbie's miraculous boyfriend, Ken, who looks like Superman himself, and it just inspires a lot of adolescent things that I think is better to hold off on if at all possible. Why? Because it puts kids on an unnatural timetable coming across, see? And they're all wrapped up in things that ought to come 10 years later. And by the time they get to adolescence, they're ready for bigger and better things. If possible, hold it off. Watch Saturday morning television with your kids sometime and see how much of it is given to an adolescent theme. I think it's better to hold that off until your kids get there. Secondly, and more importantly, prepare your kids for adolescence. For at least 15 years, I have been recommending to parents and teachers that mothers take their daughters and fathers take their sons, although it can be reversed if circumstances warrant, you know, if the relationship is such. Take them away for a weekend. If you can't afford to go away for a weekend, then go to a park for a day. But get away one-on-one. Leave the other children at home and take them in that period immediately prior to puberty. In the period between 10 and 12, 13, it could be a little after that, but it's better right before puberty. And if you watch the signs, you can see puberty coming like a freight train. You know, that growth spurt is one of the main things that you watch for. When your kids really start shooting up at that age, puberty's right around the corner. And when they get modest and when there's breast development and pubic hair, when you see these signs coming, it's getting late. Because in a few short months, it'll be very difficult to talk about some of the things that you need to talk about. Take them away on this trip for the day and tell them what's coming. See, we know that the teen years are uncomfortable. We know that that's a stressful time of life. We remember what it was for us. But it's amazing to me that we as parents keep that to ourselves and don't tell our kids. We don't share that with them. And when you do that, it's like sending them up the first dip of a roller coaster ride without telling them what waits at the top. And the trip down the other side can be harrowing for everybody on board. So I have recommended for a good while that you take this trip and in that day, tell them what to expect in the years that follow. All right, now what do you talk about on that day? Feelings of inferiority. Tell your preteen what feelings of inferiority are like. The feeling that nobody really likes me, and those who think they like me wouldn't if they really knew me. That I don't have any human worth, that everybody else is in the in-group and I'm in the out-group. Tell them that almost every teenager who ever lived struggles with these feelings. It's not just teenagers, people of all ages struggle with it, but it reaches a peak in early adolescence. That's what makes junior high so painful. Tell them that as they look around, it will look like they're the only ones that have these feelings, but that nearly everybody out there, even those laughing and joking and the football player and the homecoming queen, nearly all of them have great self-doubt during this time. Prepare your kids for this. You can help them see it as a temporary problem instead of a long-term lifestyle. And folks, I'm here to tell you, it's going to happen to your kids. And if you have junior hires and beyond, it is more likely that they are going through it right now to one degree or another. And so are you, and so have I. Because it's one of the facts of life in the Western culture, particularly. I was down on the high school campus one day walking across the grounds. The bell had rung, all the other students were back in class. And I was coming down the hall, and I saw a young man coming toward me whose name was Danny. I didn't know him very well, but I knew he was a junior. I knew his last name. But nobody knew Danny very well. He was one of those hundreds of kids on any high school campus who you just don't get acquainted with. They hang back, and they don't assert themselves. And when Danny was about 15 feet away from me, I saw that he was in trouble. And when he was about 8 feet away from me, our eyes locked. You get used to watching the faces of kids when you deal with them all the time. And I was watching him, and our eyes locked. And the moment he saw I was looking at him and that I saw he was in trouble, he dropped his eyes and he wouldn't look at me anymore. And that was a sure tip-off. And he came hurrying on past me. And when he got right alongside of me, he broke. He covered his face with both hands, and he wheeled to the wall. His neck turned red, his ears turned red, and he humped over. And he exploded. He didn't just cry. I mean, grief just flowed out of him. It was as though he had pushed it down and pushed it down and pushed it down until finally there was a moment of compassion between the two of us, and that's all it took. And he just fell apart. I put my arm around him. I said, "Danny, you feel like talking to me?" And he nodded that he did. And I practically had to lead him into my office. Sat him down, closed the door, and gave him 2 or 3 minutes to talk because he could not even express himself. But he was a very eloquent young man. He did put his thoughts into words well, but he was not the kind of student that the other kids on campus would admire. He wasn't a football player. He wasn't good looking. He didn't have the kind of qualities that they admire. And he began to talk to me. And he said, I've never tried to tell anybody this in my life. But he said, my parents moved to this school district 8 years ago. And he said, in 8 years' time, I've been working on one problem. He said, I started working on it the day we arrived, and I've worked on it right up to today. And he said, in 8 long years, I have never managed to make one single friend. He said, I walk to school by myself, and I walk home alone. I don't have anybody to walk with. I don't go to school activities. I don't go to football games and things because I don't have anybody to go with, and I'm embarrassed to sit there by myself. My phone never rings. Nobody ever calls me. He said, I don't have a girlfriend. I don't even have a boyfriend. And he said, I stand by myself at snack time like I did just now, all alone every day. And at lunch, I eat by myself. And he said, I don't like my dad, and my mother does not understand me, and I fight with my sister. And he said, in the whole world, I don't have one soul who cares whether I live or die. And he said, sometimes I think I can't stand it anymore. Now, folks, it is very difficult to deal with those kind of problems, first, during the storms of adolescence, and secondly, within the confines of the school setting. I gave Danny the warmth of my affection, and I helped him, and we talked, and I think he was a lot better off when he went out than he came in. He had ventilated emotionally. He felt better about that. But I didn't solve his problem. And I knew it, and Danny knew it, and he took his problem out the door. See, what he needed was not my love as much as the love of the students, and I couldn't give it to him. You can't demand that people respect an individual on campus who's been rejected and left out. And I couldn't give him that. All I could give him was me, and I did. And Danny and I became very good friends. And whenever I was down on the high school campus, all I had to do is just walk across the grounds at lunchtime, and Danny would appear. I could count on it. From nowhere. He'd come out from those laughing, joking students, and he would follow me until the bell rung, talking and being together. In fact, I had about 10 or 12 Dannys, like disciples, who kind of followed me, and they all had the same problem, see? They all needed people, and they weren't successful with their peers, and I kind of was a substitute in that way, because everybody needs somebody. But somehow, Danny managed to limp through that year. The following year, I was in the district office, and I received a phone call from the vice principal in charge of discipline. And he said, you know, I remember that you were friends with Danny last year. He called him by the last name. He said, he's a senior now. And he said, he did the strangest thing today, which I cannot explain, and I want you to explain to me what happened. He said, he, as you know, has never been a troublemaker. He's never gotten into any difficulty. As far as we know, he's never cut school. He just seems to be going along, getting along pretty well. And he said he was out in shop class today, and some of the boys were making fun of the way he looked. And he said instead of taking it like a man, Danny picked up a knife and stabbed one of the boys. Now, he said, I cannot understand that. Explain to me why a kid who's just going through school and he's in his fourth year and everything seems to be going along pretty well takes a little bit of pressure like that and he would lose complete control and do something so violent. I don't understand that. Now, you see, folks, the vice principal had no way of knowing what had been gnawing on Danny for then 9 years and probably a lot longer because Danny didn't tell him. Danny didn't sit in his office and say, I have hated myself for all these years, and I can't stand it when they make fun of me. Instead, Danny sits with his head down. You see, now, Danny is not an isolated case. There are thousands of Dannys all around you. They're in your neighborhood, they're in your church, they're in every school, and they don't always stab somebody, but they do strange things that you can't explain. They don't talk. They keep their head down. They don't express their thoughts. You think they're not thinking? They're thinking just like you are. They just don't have the confidence to express it. Or they're on drugs to get away from themselves for a few minutes. Or they're using alcohol. Or they are suffering in other ways. They're conforming. Or they act like a clown. Everything's funny. Slap on the back. Ha, ha, ha. Most of them have the same problem. And that is this great self-doubt that Danny had that he wasn't able to express. And I see it as a very common thing among young people and something that you can help head off if you give a little attention to it. Now, what do they feel? What do kids feel when they feel inferior? First of all, let's use a very powerful word in the English language, one with a great deal of emotion attached to it. They feel ugly. Because in our culture, human worth is identified largely with regard to beauty. It is a lousy system of evaluating human worth that leaves a lot of have-nots, in fact, nearly all of us, because none of us are physically perfect. And yet, we began evaluating the worth of a child at birth on the basis of physical beauty. Have you noticed that? See, we weigh the worth of a child. What do you say about a very cute little 3-year-old girl? Boy, she's going to be a knockout. See, you're talking already about the sexual power that she had. He'll have to beat the girls off with a stick. See, there is already an awareness that this child is worth a little more than others. And it begins at the moment of birth. They're beauty contests for babies. So we can start rewarding the fortunate very early. And this is why, folks, it's not at all uncommon for a new mother to be very depressed shortly after the birth of her first child. Because newborns are, you know, sometimes pretty beat up. And she knew better. She knew better. I mean, if you'd have talked to her, she knew better. But she somehow sort of expected about a 6-week-old winking, blinking Gerber baby. And when they hand her that red, wrinkled up, toothless, scrunched up, bald little creature, she often wants to send him back. Johnny Carson was laughing about this one night, about the delicate moment that occurs when a mother shows you a newborn child who's not very attractive, and what do you say? I mean, what do you say? There's only one thing she wants to hear. What is it? What a pretty baby. That is the only appropriate comment. Nothing else matters. The clothes, nothing matters. My, what a pretty baby. And it's kind of hard to say that at times. And he was talking about this delicate moment, and he said that he thought about it. There's not one safe thing that you can say at that moment except the one that he's come up with. And the only thing you can say is, my, that sure is a baby, isn't it? Anything else will get you in trouble. And it will, because there's great sensitivity there. You probably felt it too. Have you ever gone into the nursery after the birth of your first baby and looked through the window at all those babies along there and wondered how come yours was the only one didn't have a round head? See, we evaluate worth. We actually look at those little children, and some are more valuable than others. And it's a lousy system of evaluating human worth. But children are very aware of it. And folks, if you're taking notes, this is something I would like to underline because it is extremely important. While parents eventually adjust to whatever the child has or doesn't have and begin to get on his team and try to help him in most cases, other people don't. And the unattractive child lives in a totally different world socially from the moment of birth forward than the attractive child, and every single social encounter throughout life is influenced by it, especially in the formative years when he's finding out who he is and who cares and what he's got to compete with. We saw again this illustrated in our home when our daughter Danae was 15 months of age. And at that time, Shirley dressed her attractively, and she's a cute little toddler. And when we took her in public places, she attracted a lot of attention. She had kind of flowing hair, and people would come over to her, and they'd pick her up, and they'd hold her, and they'd buy her candy, and they'd talk about their kids, and they'd laugh and chase her. And there was a lot of just natural warmth that took place between she and other people, not because she earned it, but because she triggered a response in other people. You know what I'm talking about. Your kids probably did the same thing. And you just kind of get used to that. You expect it when you walk into a restaurant that people are going to turn around and respond. Well, when she was 15 months of age, she rearranged all of that for the worst. I had been at the hospital all day. It's a 45-minute drive home, and I was coming home on the freeway, and Shirley could not call me. And when I drove into the driveway and parked my car, Shirley came out with Danae in her arms, and there was blood all over the front of Shirley's dress, blood all over the front of Danae's face. And it was obvious that something terrible had happened. Shirley quickly told me the details, that our little toddler was playing in the living room and learning to run, and we had carpet down. We'd just put down new carpet. And Shirley was chasing her, and they were laughing and playing. And Danae, at 15 months of age, was a little unsteady, and she was running full speed ahead, and she suddenly decided to go behind a chair, and she darted to the left, caught her foot in that carpet, lost her balance, and fell into the sharp edge of a table coming down. And all of her weight as a little toddler going full speed ahead came down on her face on that sharp edge, and more specifically on the left front tooth, drove it out of sight, and raked its way up her face. And I mean, in one instant, just like that, she went from a very cute little girl to a very unattractive little girl. And the cut, you see, was on the inside of the lip, and it didn't look like an accident. It looked like she was born that way. Now, we thought the tooth was knocked out, but it was not. It was up in the gums. And I hasten to the end of the story to tell you that through some miracle, the wounds healed, and the tooth did not die. It did not turn brown. It came in straight and dropped right back into place, and the other teeth straightened out, and everything returned to normal. And that tooth's been back up there four times, friends. She was determined to knock it out, and it was a sign of fantastic courage that that tooth hung on for about 4 or 5 years. And by the time she knocked it out, it was a status symbol to have lost the tooth and be the first one on the block to have lost a tooth. So it didn't matter much at about 5 years of age to be toothless. But I want to tell you, at 15 months of age, it was a long time till that second tooth was due. And she didn't look very good. I mean, she looked terrible. She looked like, you know, she'd had a head-on collision with a freight train. And because the cuts and so on were on the inside, it really looked like she was born that way. So she just went from this position of social attractiveness to unattractiveness very quickly for a very short period of time. Well, the next night, I'd kind of forgotten about it, and I took her with me to a store to buy something. I was standing there in line waiting to pay for it, and I don't know what I was thinking about. You know, you have more than one level of consciousness, but something over here was bothering me. And I remember turning to see what it was, and I saw instantly that there was something very different about the way people were responding to my little girl now as compared with before. See, instead of buying her candy and holding her and loving her and everything, people would look at her and then they'd turn away. Now, they weren't trying to reject her. They weren't trying to be mean to her. They wouldn't have hurt her for anything. They didn't see her. This is my point. If you and I were driving down the freeway in a car and I said, "What color car just went by?" You were looking right at it. You'd say, I don't know. I wasn't thinking about it. See, you don't see it. You were looking right at it, and you can't tell me what color it is. An unattractive child is like that. You see right past them. You don't see them. You're not trying to reject them. You just do not see them. And it irritated me greatly, folks, as I stood there and watched this, and it seemed so unfair, not only on behalf of my daughter at that moment, but on behalf of all children everywhere. It seemed unfair to reward a child for something that he didn't earn. And that's bad. But what's worse, to destroy or reject a child for something that's not his fault. And yet this is the value system of our culture, and it is very widespread. You take two children into a restaurant at 2 years of age, one's cute and one's not cute, and watch what the waitress will do. She'll gush all over one and leave the other one and his parents sitting there as though he doesn't exist. It is amazing to me how we evaluate human worth on this way. So, folks, if a child is too tall or too short or too fat or too thin, or his ears stick out, or his nose is hooked one way or another, or his hair isn't right, or he's got a tornado of freckles on his face, or his fanny's a little too big, or his feet are too big, it really does not matter what it is. If he has one flaw, all that it takes is for other children who are amazingly creative in this regard to identify a nickname, to spotlight that one flaw, and he becomes a flaw, and self-esteem starts to deteriorate.
Oh my goodness, it is so true. Our culture rewards those who look good and ignores and demeans those who are considered flawed, and how sad a commentary is that on today's culture. You've been listening to the first part of my dad's presentation on preparing for adolescence from way back in 1978 from the very first film series. And as I mentioned at the top of the program, we are excited to announce the release of our new film series titled Building a Family Legacy. Regardless of where you're at in life, your legacy matters. The new Building a Family Legacy series is tremendously compelling. It features books, films, study guides, and Bible studies designed to help you reclaim your family for God's glory. In celebration of its release, we are streaming the first film in the new series for free starting October 1st through the 5th. You can sign up by visiting buildingafamilylegacy.com. We'd also like to give you some of our most popular and mobile-friendly resources, starting with Family Talk's Legacy Digital Resource Guide. It's interactive, convenient, and the perfect companion for helping you create those legacy moments with your family. Just text your email address and the keyword legacy to 51555 to get it now. Again, your email address and the keyword legacy to 51555. God bless. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you again next time for the conclusion of Preparing for Adolescence right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.